Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Rational Face Podcast, the best podcast on the Blabbernacle. We have yet another episode in store for you. Ben Park and I discuss a wonderful book written by Kathleen Flake called The Politics of American Religious Identity, The Seating of Senator Reed Smoot, Mormon Apostle. Before we get into that discussion, I want to make sure all you listeners out there are aware of the survey that we are conducting at Rational Faiths. We are curious to know what blog readers and podcast listeners think about the Blabbernacle and the Blabbernacle. So jump over there and look for a post titled, A Survey, a fun little survey that has a navel orange as the featured image. And if you get the joke that relates the survey and the navel orange, I'll give you 10 shrewd bucks. Honestly. Additionally, I'd like to ask those faithful listeners to go to iTunes and leave a rating and a review. Even if this is the only series, if you're just a history nerd or a budding Mormon history nerd, if this is the only series that you listen to, give us a review anyway. And in your review, write out why this is so wonderful. Anyway, with that plugging business out of the way, let's get down to the discussion with Ben Park about poor old Reed Smoot. Hey, Ben, it's good to talk to you again. How in the world are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, Brian. How are you?
I'm doing good, too. So, we get to talk about Kathleen Flake's book. This one produced more notes than any other as far as scribbling down quotes or interesting bits there. This one was really phenomenal, especially given that it's, what, 100 and... not quite 200 pages, I think.
Well, I think it's 140. Wait, no, sorry, 177.
Yeah, 177 pages, but it is packed with interesting history.
It is one of the most readable books in Mormon history, I think. It is just a masterpiece. In fact, if you want a great example of the move from New Mormon History to Mormon Studies, it's probably harder to find a better example than this book. That is just, it's sleek, it's small, it's efficient, and it's predominantly focused on using Mormonism as a case study for lots of broader issues. In this case, looking at Reed Smoot and his congressional hearings from 1904 to 1907, and what it tells us about the intersections of American religious and political identities at the turn of the century.
So this was 2 years after the Mormon question.
Right.
So it seemed like right in the early 2000s there was this shift, and you got an onslaught of these really great books.
Absolutely.
Wasn't Prince's book, the David O. McKay, was that about that same time?
2005.
Okay, yeah, so that continued a really good trend.
Another good comparison, because whenever you're thinking about Mormonism in this period, the book that comes to mind and should still be a necessary read for people is Thomas Alexander's Mormonism in Transition, which is his book that covers the church between 1890 and 1920 or 1930. I forget his cutoff date, but it's a magisterial book that gets into all the details, all the nitty-gritty parts of how everything changes, and it does an excellent job of subtly using theory and bringing in broader context to understand what Mormonism was going through. And then you have, you know, Kathleen Flake's book, which is building on that, right? That now that Thomas Alexander lays that foundation, Kathleen Flake can pick out elements out of that story and now use it to in turn cast a mirror back to the broader American public. And so now let's talk about why this matters to American history writ large.
So we have the Reed Smoot trial, and then there's the Scopes Monkey trial,
Is that another example of this political religious identity down the road?
Absolutely. The Scopes Monkey Trial is pretty crucial to the development, or at least it symbolizes what's going on in these debates over the role of religion and its authority within public life. And yeah, that deserves its own podcast. It's a fascinating story.
All right. So this is the shift away from the 19th century, and there's seemingly a change in how history is done.
Absolutely. And so, like, just as Mormonism transitions quite a bit, going from the 19th to the 20th century, Mormon history writing, meaning our coverage of these periods, changed dramatically. If you were to look at a shelf of books written on Mormon history, probably about 90% of them were written covering the pre-1900 period. There's just not a lot done in the 20th century. There's reasons for this. Some people see it just not as sexy a topic. It's not as exciting. But there's also an issue of sources not being available, depending on what kind of sources you're going after. On the one sense, there's a lot more sources because there's a lot of newspapers and public sources, but there's not as much access to private diaries. We don't have papers from church leaders in the 20th century like we do in the 19th century. So you see this odd dynamic to where a lot of the coverage of 20th century Mormonism is biographical, meaning that's focused on one person or a small group of people. And that's usually because the author has access to a treasure trove of personal papers, whether it's Greg Prince getting access to David O. McKay's secretary's papers, or Edward Kimball getting access to his father, Spencer W. Kimball's papers, or Michael Quinn getting access to J. Reuben Clark's papers. So you see this odd shift. And so on the one hand, Kathleen Flake's book here, it kind of bucks that trend in that she says, well, you know what? We don't need to get into these personal papers. Personal papers are great, and we use them as much as we can. But you can also pull out a lot from these public sources. And it helps that there's, you know, this national congressional trial going on that produces a lot of these public sources. But yeah, so you'll notice when you look at 20th century Mormon history, that you notice this trend of how it's being framed.
Yeah, so this is one of those examples of Mormon studies. But before we get into the actual book, why don't you tell us who Kathleen Flake is? She's not one of these names like Richard Bushman or D. Michael Quinn that get tossed around a lot. Tell us about her and who she is and how she contributed.
It's a shame her name doesn't get cast around a lot, because she's a brilliant scholar, one of the leading scholars not just Mormon history, but religious history in America now. She was a lawyer for a while, and then after her legal career, she decided to go in academia. She got her PhD from Chicago Divinity School, was hired by Vanderbilt in Tennessee, a very prestigious religious studies graduate program at the Divinity School there. She taught there for over a decade, and then a few years ago, she was selected to be the inaugural holder of the Richard Lyman Bushman Chair of Mormon Studies at the University of Virginia, which is one of the most prestigious positions for someone focused that does Mormon history, one of the most prestigious, a well-respected position just in religious history in general, one of the top religious studies programs in America. And she's currently working on a book on gender, Mormon polygamy, and power structures in 19th century. So basically the Joseph Smith period and the early Utah period. And she's published a little bit on that research recently in a Journal of Mormon History volume. The 50th anniversary issue has a wonderful treatment of different marriage rituals in Mormonism. So yeah, she's a very critical thinker. And given with all this background, it really allows her to dig into what are often staid topics and give valuable insights that most historians have previously overlooked.
All right. Well, with that background on Kathleen Flake, the author, let's jump into the overview of the book as a whole. It seems to me that this book is some form of a redo or a recapitulation of the Mormon question, where it's the church grappling with some outside secular force, being the United States government, and dealing with the same problem all over again a decade and a half later.
Right. You can very much see this book as a sequel to Sally Gordon's book. But in important ways, it kind of takes a different direction. With Sally Gordon's book, the question is, what does the Constitution do with these groups that are on the fringes of societies and want to remain on the fringes of society? Whereas now that Mormons have taken this turn and want to assimilate into American culture, the question is, how do religious cultures become part of the mainstream? And she actually has two central questions to her book that drive most of her research. The first question is, how do religious communities change over time, yet still retain a sense of sameness with their originating vision? Another friend of mine who's a professor of religion puts it more bluntly when he says that every successful religion has to accomplish two things. First, it has to be able to adapt to new times and new circumstances and new generations. And number two, it has to convince its followers that it's not adapting to new times and generations and circumstances. And then the second question that's much more political, is what are the political terms by which diverse religions are brought within America's constitutional order? So what concessions do the Mormons have to do to become part of the political mainstream and achieve the rights and the citizenship that they feel they deserve?
Right. This is not just a story about Mormonism, but also about the Protestants and that grappling or exchange of authority or submission, I guess, is the way you're describing it, the Mormons submitting a little bit.
Absolutely. This book is about the development of Protestant America as much as it is about the Mormons. And it's focusing specifically on how the Protestant authority is declining at the same time as the Mormonism sent, that Protestantism can no longer dictate the moral standards through which fringe religious groups can achieve citizenship. And so Protestantism needed to lose its grasp on main culture in order for Mormonism to get a seat at the table, to mix way too many metaphors. And so she also summarizes her approach as looking at what she calls conflicting authorities. And she means this in two ways. She's looking at, to whom do Mormons grant sovereignty? Meaning, where do Mormons see overall power? Do they see authority seen primarily in their religion with their prophets and their God, or do they recognize that to be subsumed under the American political authority? And then secondly, what authority did Protestantism possess in American politics? To what extent could Protestantism dictate who is included and who is not? And so to summarize really quick, this is a quote that comes from page 8 of the book. Kathleen Flake says, quote, "I argue that the U.S. Senate's solution to the nation's Mormon problem was a compromise that required the Mormons to conform their kingdom to that most Protestant form of religion, the denomination, with its definitive values of obedience to law, loyalty to the nation, and creedal tolerance. In return, the Senate gave the Latter-day Saints the benefit they sought by sending a representative to the Senate, namely that form of religious citizenship that provided them protection at home and abroad for the propagation of their faith."
Yeah, I think that's a really good, succinct summary from the author herself of what the book aims to achieve, and in my opinion, did achieve that. But with that overview in hand, let's jump into some of the highlights or main points from each chapter. The first chapter, like most Mormon history books, gives the background, which is like a mini summary of Mormon theology or Mormon history, and most importantly is an overview of the historical relationship between Mormonism and the United States.
Absolutely, and especially the different assumptions that are coming from both backgrounds. So Mormons are coming from this emphasis on kingdoms and theocracy, where they believe religious and political authority are found in their ecclesiastical leaders, and they're having to soften this approach if they want to be part of the American body. Whereas on the other hand, the Americans have deep suspicions that Mormons were, you know, trying to make a power play or trying to make a move and were not really being upfront with their motives. And therefore, they needed to be watchful of what the Mormons did. And then, of course, at the center of all this conflict was polygamy, the practice of that Mormons had supposedly given up in 1890, though, of course, as most listeners know, and as we'll talk about further, it continues on and is a thorn in the side of the Mormon movement to become part of the mainstream culture. And it sets the stage for now that Mormons are wanting to be part of America. Are they willing to give up not just the practice of polygamy, but the deep theological and cultural beliefs that were tethered to it?
Right. And as Flake says on page 30, many Latter-day Saints thought that the manifesto was a political expediency designed to save the church, and they therefore continued to practice continued to practice polygamy. All of the Gentiles were convinced that it was a ruse. So for me, this insight shows how differently many church members viewed the 1890 Manifesto in comparison to how many modern 20th and 21st century Mormons view it, and how not only Mormons but non-Mormons both viewed it as some sort of stunt at the time. Mormons had not yet earned the trust of their Protestant neighbors.
Right. Their relationship was not on good standing at this point.
Yeah.
Which then sets the stage for Chapter 2, where is background into Reed Smoot. Now, Reed Smoot is the ideal test case for the Mormons to get someone in the Senate. He's Republican at a time when the Republican Party is trying to reach out and have more power in the Western states. And so they saw that if they could get Reed Smoot and the Mormons on their side, they can have a lot more votes, and they could, and Utah could, and a lot of the Mountain West states that had Mormon votes would be part of a swing state for the party. He was also monogamous. Unlike a lot of other apostles at the time, he did not enter into polygamy. And he was a sober fellow, meaning that he was serious, he was reflective, he was a successful businessman, and he just seemed like the perfect individual to present in the Senate. I mean, he's the kind where you just look at the picture and you realize, gosh, that guy looks boring. But I mean, it's the boringness in the sense of where he's a banker. He's you just know he keeps a checkbook. He is the model citizen that if Mormons want to have a public face, he's the guy.
Yeah, and he also looks like Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood.
I can see that.
I did a quick little reconstruction of the Quorum of the Twelve and the First Presidency at this time when Charles Penrose, he's ordained in July 1904. And at that point, the top 15 leadership were comprised of 6 monogamists and 9 polygamists, which makes for 40% of the most influential Mormons to be monogamous at this point.
Right.
So that indicates to me that the 1890 Manifesto and the broader cultural changes were already affecting the church leadership.
Right.
And this event of the Reed Smoot trial just pushes that even further.
Absolutely, especially as we'll talk about 1905, 1906, 1907, when they're having to force the second manifesto. It's quite a trying time for the Saints. And what I really like about the book as a whole, in Chapter 2 in particular, is it presents Smoot as a very sympathetic guy. He's a guy that he's a progressive in the sense that he matches a lot of the cultural trends of the era. He's a successful businessman. He's a modernist. He does not have much time for speculation and other things. He becomes frustrated with the church when they're not making the changes that he think is necessary. And he's a man that's really tore up inside, unable to figure out which side to cast his lot on. Does he really want to solidify his ties with American politics, or are his primary allegiances with the church? And that's quite emblematic of his trial, because in the trial, it was never really Smoot who was on trial, but rather it was the church that was on trial. So Smoot is elected to the Senate. He is immediately challenged for his seat by a committee to determine whether a Mormon is fit to serve as a senator. And the trial was really to see if the church was willing to follow the American idea of a religion or not. It was never about Reed Smoot and his own private affairs and such.
Now, just a few years earlier, was it B.H. Roberts?
Right.
That was he elected to?
Yeah, he was elected to the House of Representatives, and he was denied his seat. And this is actually quite an important facet of it. So, an important part of the story, because B.H. Roberts was, you know, a 70, but more importantly, he was a polygamist. And I think we can understand why the Congress is not happy of having a polygamist in the House of Representatives. So he was denied his seat. He never got to act as a representative. And whereas in the Senate, they have a different approach to getting your seat, where Reed Smoot was able to take his seat, start acting as a senator, and while being a senator, he was being tried for his Senate position. And so this caused a lot of commotion in Utah, because by bringing new scrutiny under the church, it meant that a lot of people who were polygamists, who had entered polygamous relationships after the manifesto, had to go into hiding. Lots of people were upset with Joseph F. Smith, the prophet at the time, for allowing this to happen. Many people were asking Smith to call off the whole charade. But Smith was actually quite fervent in emphasizing that this trial had to happen, that this was a necessary step for America to become, well, American. And I think he might have, at certain moments over the next few years, he might have regretted that decision.
Yeah, I imagine so. So then into chapter three, we see that it's not, it is about Reed Smoot, but it's not about Reed Smoot, and he's not the only one that's scrutinized, but the church as a whole, the church leadership especially, gets put underneath the magnifying glass, and especially the president of the church, Joseph F. Smith, was put on trial and asked many pointed questions.
Right. And so if you can just imagine the president of the church standing in front of a Senate committee trying to determine whether the Mormon church is inimical to the American political order. And so when this trial starts, they send out for many different church leaders to testify at the trial. Many refuse, many go into hiding, many go up into Canada or down to Mexico. Heber J. Grant goes out to England. But Joseph F. Smith takes the stand, and in a way he steals the show. He becomes quite a central figure in these trials and kind of captures the national attention. And chapter three is focused on Smith and his what he says on the stand. And it's quite a gripping tale. I taught this class in a class on religion and politics here at the University of Missouri last semester. I had all my students read this book and we discussed it, and almost all of them came back saying, yeah, this Reed Smoot guy is interesting, these politics, yeah, blah, 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 blah. But this Joseph F. Smith character, he's fascinating. And so this story really gets into what an interesting character Joseph Smith does. He takes a stand. He wears a pin on his suit lapel of his father, who was killed in Joseph Smith's mind, due to the Democratic Party, which is one reason why he was always a Republican, even though the Republicans had led the charge on anti-polygamy prosecutions. He's very shifty in his answers. He never wants to give a straight answer. He only gives enough of an answer to kind of satisfy the question, but not enough to indict him or the church on very simple topics. I mean, it must have been really frustrating for those questioning him. They would ask things like, does your church practice polygamy? And he would say, well, members who are a part of the church practice polygamy, but the church itself does not practice polygamy. Or do you receive revelation as a prophet? And he would say, well, I am a prophet and I receive inspiration, and the members of the church are able to either accept or reject my teachings as they so desire. And these are questions that shouldn't be as difficult as he's making them, but he's making them for a number of reasons, but mostly just because he doesn't want to give anything that's incriminating to the church. I don't know. What did you think, Brian, of these answers that he was giving?
It was entertaining, to say the least, but it's just such a different way to view a prophet. You know, having grown up, especially with President Hinckley as the prophet of my youth, our youth, I should say, he was very secure on camera and on 60 Minutes and, you know, was quite commanding. And we don't get that sort of commanding presence as you read through the trial proceedings. And so it gives a very different picture of a prophet than we're used to. We're usually seeing them at general conference preaching about keeping commandments, living the gospel, and what have you. But here we see a prophet clearly uncomfortable under the congressional microscope. One quote from a reporter at the time conveys at least one view of the prophet on page 60. It says, nearest the door is President Joseph F. Smith, a man of 5 feet, eight or nine, with broad shoulders and a short neck and a general appearance of squattiness, which to me, all the pictures that I've seen, I wouldn't call him squatty. He looks quite thin. But anyway, continuing, he says, his eyes are small and shifty. They sparkle behind the glasses and are never still. His words are well chosen. It is evident that he has much practice in talking to the public. His temper is not well in hand, for at times he flares up and answers questions sharply. He rarely moves when other witnesses are on the stand. He watches each man closely, but betrays neither satisfaction at nor disapproval of the testimony. So quite a different picture of a prophet, I think. And Flake says this portrayal is the personification of the Mormon viper on the hearth, of this sneaky, untrustworthy entity.
Absolutely.
That the way Protestant America would have viewed them.
Absolutely. And I really liked one of the most powerful sections of the book is when she gets into these ethics of lying on the stand. Because, I mean, there's a lot. Smith is shifty in a lot of regards, and there's other parts where he flat out lies about certain things. And she talks about the ethics of these religious people who come to an understanding to where what they believe what they're doing is not lying, but preserving their conscience for the cause of God and so forth. And this is pretty common amongst other religions. We have a pithy saying for it in the church where we call it lying for the Lord. But I think there's a lot of ethical and deep-rooted contextual issues that Flake unpacks that I found quite fascinating.
It's one of those moments where you have to kind of visualize yourself what you would do in one of these. I don't like to use the word extreme because I think of those in, you know, someone with their gun to your head or something like that, but it's definitely a not normal situation. And, you know, how would you respond with the responsibility that you have to protect yet also represent the church? I don't know. It'd be interesting if we could all redo that and see what we would do. But here, the church is on trial in order to determine who the members will ultimately obey, either the law of the land or the law of God. And should the two be at odds, which one are they going to pick?
Exactly. And of course, the prime example that they brought out besides polygamy was the mysterious temple oath that church members would give in the temple of swearing allegiance to God and the church and avenging the blood of Joseph and Hiram. And other things, because this they felt was quite crucial. Can you be a member of the American nation and be pledging your allegiance to this secretive religious organization while covered in the temple, you know, sheltered from outcrying from peeping eyes? And one of the political cartoons that is used in this book that I think is quite profound is it's a political cartoon skewering Smoot and the church for him hiding behind the Salt Lake Temple. Like, he has a big cutout of the Salt Lake Temple and he's holding it, and Smoot is holding it in front of him so that while people are throwing rocks at him, he's holding the temple to be a shield, basically saying, neener, neener, you can't get me. I'm hiding behind my temple. which kind of gets into this fear that Americans had for the role secrecy played. But then, of course, the other major issue was polygamy. And it became quite clear that for Smoot to keep a seat and for the church to be accepted within the American mainstream, they had to do a more convincing job of ending their practice of polygamy. So they basically dictate for Joseph F. Smith to present what's called the Second Manifesto in 1904, which basically is saying, hey, you remember when we said we're not practicing polygamy anymore? Well, we really mean it this time, guys. Let's knock it off. And this was a document not easily passed amongst the leaders of the church. Lots of people were not fans of it, most famously Matthias Cowley and John W. Taylor, two apostles, both sons of apostles, John W. Taylor being the son of John Taylor, the former president of the church. They did not support it. And so there's a question of, are they going to be dismissed from the quorum? But it wasn't just them. There are many others. Here's Heber J. Grant. And Heber J. Grant is basically, you know, when you think of Heber J. Grant's personality, you think it's about as entertaining as milquetoast, right? That he just seems like this boring banker dude who has never done anything interesting in his life. But here's him reacting in January of 1906 to the question of whether Taylor and Cowley were going to have to be dropped from the quorum. He's writing this from England, remember, where he's kind of in exile from during these hearings. So Heber J. Grant says, quote, "With all my heart, I plead for those two brethren that they may be protected no matter what the enemy may ask." The enemy, of course, here is America. Quote, "What they have done, I have also done or intended to do. From the bottom of my heart, I plead for my brethren, even if Reed," i.e. Reed Smoot, "has to resign if that would do any good in our case." So he's basically saying that we should not appease to the government. We need to stay firm. And this is coming from Heber J. Grant, the guy who, you know, is the president of the church from 1917 through the 1940s.
It's interesting to see how Heber J. Grant, who ends up being president of the church down the road, has to enforce this polygamy ban. So 10 to 15 years before he became president, he was ready to keep on preaching polygamy.
Right.
And so I guess we change over time.
And there, as Flake mentioned, there's a sincere question about whether Joseph F. Smith was sincere in his second manifesto. And she concludes that she's not convinced that he would not have continued plural marriage even as late as 1906. And so, I mean, this is still a live topic.
Yeah, there's ways to read that, like many read the 1890 manifesto as the political statement. And some of the other problems were these transcripts from the trial were being recorded and printed in newspapers. And in our very own, Utah's very own Salt Lake Tribune, some of the transcripts were printed there. And from what I can tell, it was quite disturbing for members of the church to hear some of the transcripts from the trial.
Right. There's a lot of members of the church that weren't very happy with how Joseph F. Smith was holding himself. And so Joseph F. Smith had to come and at general conference and reassure the saints that what I'm doing is necessary for the kingdom's preservation. And it causes a lot of trouble within the church. And that leads directly into chapter 5, which is the heavily theoretical chapter in the book, the very religious studies-y, in that it's drawing from, you know, these French theorists whose names we're not going to try to pronounce, but present these theories of how religious organizations operate. And so Kathleen Flake says, now that the church was facing this crisis of identity, how do they reassure the faith? And she says that they do this by placing their emphasis not on Joseph Smith's later life, where polygamy is, of course, central. And now they're reasserting the beginning of his life, which is, you know, his calling as a prophet and especially the first vision. And it just so happens that the Reed Smoot trials overlap with the church's celebration of Joseph Smith's centennial celebration, his 100th year birthday. And they go out and dedicate a huge monument in Sharon, Vermont. And they do this church history tour where they visit Vermont, Palmyra, they go to Kirtland, and then just very suspiciously, they skip Nauvoo, which she says is quite symbolic of them now choosing which parts of their history to emphasize and shore up their faith, and that's done through reemphasizing the First Vision and downplaying Nauvoo.
I want to share one quote on this little trip in the monument building, just to show that this wasn't just, hey, we need to create some press to distract from these trials or something, but this was very much planned. This was, I think, a very conscious shift from Joseph F. Smith's mind to redirect the church. I think it's the size of the monument shows how serious this undertaking is, or it's symbolic to it anyway. So, the huge cement foundation symbolized the primitive church, or the foundation thou hast laid of apostles and prophets with Jesus Christ, thy Son, as the chief cornerstone. Upon this foundation was laid a 4-foot-thick, 30-ton granite base, typifying the rock of Revelation. Finally, erected on the base and measuring a foot for each year of his life, a 38.5-foot shaft of granite represented Joseph Smith himself. The shaft was polished to symbolize Smith's reflecting the light of heaven, and was crowned to illustrate Smith's successful completion of his mission and the possibility for all to be similarly glorified. So this is a serious monument to go out to Vermont in the middle of winter. It's not even a nice time of year to do construction of any sort and put this huge monument out there. So this is in my mind, this is a very conscious effort to reorient the saints.
Right, right. And so with that in mind, and it's a fascinating chapter that I recommend, chapter 6 is the final chapter where it moves into the final arguments of the Senate hearing. They're still trying to find the smoking gun to prove that Reed Smoot is either a polygamist or is supporting polygamists. They think they find one in a BYU professor who claims that the BYU president at the time was a practicing polygamist and had a new wife, and they went down into the quote unquote Book of Mormon lands, but the president was more interested in finding a new wife than ancient Book of Mormon relics. This argument ends up failing because Reed Smoot and others could say that, well, we actually fired that president and excommunicated him, which, you know, goes against the argument that the church is condoning the action. And then the end of the hearing is pretty anticlimactic. The Senate committee itself votes to unseat Smoot, but that was only a small number of members. And then when it goes to the entirety of the Senate, Smoot is reaffirmed by about 2-1, two votes for to every vote against. It had been a 3-year-long case, and in that time, Reed Smoot had endeared himself to many of his Senate colleagues. The Republican Party had seen him as crucial. Teddy Roosevelt, the president at the time, threw his support behind him. But most importantly, it symbolize a broader trend within the Senate and America. The nation had grown more confident that it could manage monopolies, whether it be banking, financial, political, or religious with the Mormons. So they figure, you know what, we can manage the Mormons, so it's okay if they have a senator. And most importantly, the Mormon church recognized that they needed to act more as a civil religion, which meant giving up polygamy for good, recognizing the authority of the state, and the Senate in turn had to stop acting as a civil religion. And in fact, I love one of the closing quotes of the chapter where Kathleen Flake said, "The Mormons learned to act more like a civil religion, and the Senate learned to act less like one."
So we finally have a secular government.
Right, and it's all been solved since then.
Right,
it's never been a problem in church and state after that.
No, that's all pretty clear. that's the sixth chapter. The epilogue is just saying that the ground is now set for 20th century Mormonism, where this shift has taken place, moving de-emphasizing Joseph's last revelation of polygamy and re-emphasizing, putting first and foremost, his very first revelation, which is the first vision. And it just goes to show that in many ways, Mormonism of the 20th century is a distinctly different religion from its 19th century version.
Right, at least in relation to its relationship to the state.
Yeah, and just as we're recording this, I'm right in the middle of the other book that you mentioned, Mormonism in Transition, and it's interesting to compare these two. Mormonism in Transition is about twice as long, roughly, and it's a lot more detailed. This one is really nice because it's only 177 pages long, and it flows really well. It's just so well done. And that's not to say that Mormonism in Transition is not well done. It's just, it's like you were saying, it's more Mormon history than Mormon studies, I guess.
And it's meant to be exhaustive, right?
Every chapter is kind of tiring to get through. It's interesting. There's lots of fascinating and important stuff in there, but it's very, very detailed.
And those books are needed, right? I mean, if that book wasn't written, then the Politics of American Religious Identity would not have the shoulders to stand on.
Right.
But I mean, that's the benefit of Flake's book, is it's short. It has fascinating characters. I guess I won't say lovable characters, because I think sometimes you can be quite frustrated with these guys, especially the people who are trying to testify under oath. And they're dodging questions in such a ridiculous way. And it ends up being quite humorous at times with how they're dodging questions. Like one father asked about his son entering polygamy. And he's like, well, do you know if your son entered polygamy? He's like, well, it's not my business. It's my son's business. Well, you live right down the street from him. Of course you would know. And yeah.
Wasn't he the one that was he this the case where he was the one that actually sealed him?
Right, right.
He's like, I don't know, I wasn't really paying attention that day.
Right. So I mean, it's just a fun book to read, and it's really important.
Yeah, yeah, yes, it is. There's the bishop's wife in my ward has a history degree, and she remembered having a semester of Mormon history and reading this book, and I was reading it early in the summer, and we were at some camp out, and she was like, oh, you're reading that. And the only thing she could remember, because it had been years later, was that she was surprised how troublesome this period was and how much the church changed through this transitional period.
Right.
And that it was not as smooth and as continuous and constant as she had originally thought.
Right.
Well, I think that wraps it up for the Politics of American Religious Identity. Thanks again for being with us, Ben. Next month, we will talk about Armin Moss's book, The Angel and the Beehive.
Looking forward to it.
I hope you found that discussion helpful and interesting. Interesting for sure to see a prophet and church change, and especially the sections about Joseph F. Smith being put under a microscope. Don't forget a few things before you go. First, go to iTunes and leave a review. And second, go and find the Rational Faith post titled A Fun Little Survey, and take the survey, and let me know who I owe 10 shrewd bucks to. As for next week, I'll be releasing a recording from one of Brad Kramer's events he had at his bookstore, Grit and Vision. He had an event a month or two ago about John Dominic Crossan's book, How to Read the Bible and Still Be a Christian. And it's a series of reviews from our very own Colby Townsend, among others, reviewing the book, and then a presentation with question and answers with the author himself, John Dominic Crossan, who is a well-known, well-regarded Bible scholar. And so, look forward to that, and until next time, keep keeping it weird.